Okay. Hey, this is the book of Hebrews. Jesus is better. We're going to be in the first sentence of the book. It starts off in verses 1, 1, and 2. The kind of the theme of this is God has spoken to us in a son. And we're going to look at verses 1 through 4, actually. As I said, the first sentence, the first four verses is one complete, elegant sentence. And it's a sentence that with ideas that begin in eternity past and take us all the way forward and end in eternity future. And what he does with this little sentence is he introduces the next topic, which is about Jesus and angels. The thing that's amazing is what Bill just did on the supremacy of Jesus Christ. That's what this book is about. And Bill made a statement that we come to believe in Jesus, but then after that we must pursue him. It's almost like that's two different things. The book of Hebrews says believing in Jesus is pursuing Jesus in this life. Because this book is the only one that talks about his ministry as a great high priest in the present time and what he's doing for us now. This is a book about pursuit, about staying on track, about staying in the race. And many people approach this book and they say, well, is this book written for believers or is it only for unbelievers? And how do you tell if you're a believer and not a believer? Misses the point. The point is if you are believing in Jesus, you will be pursuing. And he makes several arguments and will give several examples about how can you tell if you're believing in Jesus? Because you're pursuing and you're obeying. If you're not, it's because you're not believing. Very simple. It's simple, but it's very profound. And this guy writes, we don't know who it is. He writes with elegant Greek style. He doesn't write in a common street Greek like Paul and Peter. He writes with almost a classical style. You have to have a little better education than the average Greek to understand this letter in terms of its Greek language. So it's a very elegant book. So we're going to start with this verse sentence. I'm going to read it, and you're going to read it along in your translations and in your Bibles. I'm reading from the New American Standard. And I found as I surveyed all of the different translations, ESV, New American Standard, New International Version, Revised Standard Version, and King James, they're all pretty much essentially the same. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in a Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels, as he inherited a more excellent name than they. In your Bible, that's about four sentences, but in the Greek New Testament, it's one sentence. And I translated this, and I don't translate it to become smarter. I translated it because translation, what it does, when you're going from one language to another, it slows you down. So we just read through this in about 60 seconds? 90 seconds? That's like getting all of a sudden a gush and a pour of rain. What happens if you get a real heavy rain that rains a lot of water? Most of it runs off. Does some of it get in? Sure. But what happens if you get a nice, gentle sprinkle? Takes longer to get the same amount of water, but what happens? It soaks in. So when I've translated this, it's really slowed me down. Now, you can do this without translating from one language to another. You can do it just by simply taking an English dictionary and start looking up these words. Or take a Bible dictionary and start looking up these words. Make yourself slow down. I see my wife do this almost every morning. She studies with a pencil and a pad, and she'll maybe take a month to go through a book, because she's carefully making notes and she's looking and comparing, looking up definitions. So that's what we're going to do with the book of Hebrews. It's going to take us a while. What we're going to do is slow down and let it soak in. We're just going to take the first little piece, the first little bite. And the book starts off with these words. It doesn't start with these words in any translation I looked at. But in the Greek New Testament, it starts with these words. A play on words, many and many, long ago. God spoke. And he spoke to the fathers through the prophets, very specifically, until now. It's all different. Now he has spoken to us through a son. Contrast with the past and the present. He spoke to the fathers. Now he speaks to us. He spoke through the prophets. Now he speaks through a son. God spoke in the past to the fathers through the prophets. And he started off with these words, many, many portions and many, many ways. Now let's stop and think. How many different ways did God speak before Jesus in the Old Testament? How many ways did we see him communicate himself, his character, his nature, his love, his grace, his judgment? So he spoke to people. Is that all he did? How did he reveal himself to the Egyptians?
Through the miracles.
Yeah. Dreams. Right?
And then visions.
Yeah. Prophecies. He revealed himself through the prayers of men. Men would pray and speak things about God. Psalms, poetry, songs, wisdom literature, proverbs.
Burning bush.
These are second supernatural manifestations. Is God really a burning bush? No. But is he like fire? Yes. Look at all the different men involved in writing down what God had told them to say. All the writing prophets. And there were non-writing prophets, but prophets who never wrote anything. Probably one of the greatest prophets after Moses never wrote a word.
Elijah.
They wrote about him, but he didn't write any books. There's no book by Elijah. But he was a great, great prophet. So great that when Jesus comes to the Mount of Transfiguration, what two guys show up? Moses and Elijah. The first greatest and second greatest promise in the entire Old Testament. They show up at Jesus, the Mount of Transfiguration. God has written a book over 2,000 years with 40 different authors with different personalities and ways that he worked with them differently. Visions, dreams, spoke to directly. And the book is absolutely consistent. The entire book is consistent within itself. There's no other book you can say that about. That's a miracle. So this son, and it calls him a son. The word his in most translations are supplied. But this son, he made this son the heir of everything. Actually, he created the universe through the son. And the son radiates his glory and it has exactly the same nature. This is what he's now going to go on to say about the son. God spoke through a son, but I'm going to tell you now about the son. This is what the author of Hebrews is saying. I'm going to tell you about this son. Now let's stop a minute and think of this. The son is the heir of everything, right? Everything that belongs to the family belongs to him. If you have a son, you obviously have a father. So he's talking about this God is his father. And he says not only is he the heir of everything, actually he's the agent of God's creation of everything. Now think of this in a theatrical sense. Let's just play around with this a little bit. God is the author. It's all God's words. He's the author. The son is the producer. And we are the actors. And so whose direction are we under? We are under the direction of the Son, who's producing this entire event from the very beginning of creation. When there was nothing, how did everything get here? His Son was the agent of the creation, authored by God the Father. And he is God's actual Son. Now this is really where it gets amazing. We don't think this is so strange. Jesus is God's son. Yeah, we know that. He's the son of God. He's God of God, very God himself. But you got to have a picture that who is this book written to? A basically Jewish audience. And the Jewish people have a huge problem with any man claiming to be God. I mean, this is the basis of the division between Christianity and Judaism today, that we claim Jesus is God of very God. The Jews say that's impossible. God condemned that. Our God is one. But Jesus radiates his glory. Now there's two ways you can take that Greek word and translate it. You can translate it as reflection, but you can also translate it as a radiation from a source. I think the correct interpretation of this is the Son radiates the very glory of God because he is in essence God. We reflect the glory of God. Why do we reflect and not radiate? Because we don't have it in ourselves. We're reflecting what God has given us, what God has done for us. But it doesn't come from within us. This is the nature of him. He radiates God's glory. This son owns everything. This son created everything. This son radiates the glory of God. This son is exactly the same nature as God. Now you know something about this son you didn't know with just the broad category of the word son. He wants to define the son by his description, not just let us assume that we know who that is. This is so dramatic in what he's saying that this is either really true or it's really crazy. Because you're saying this man was the agent of creation. I thought God created the world. Jesus was the one through whom everything was created. Colossians tells us that. John tells us that. The Son is in charge. The Son holds everything together by his word, which is powerful. This is powerful. And he has taken a seat at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. The one who is truly wonderful. Now, the reason I did that one who is truly wonderful, because there's really no way to translate that word majesty in heaven into English. We go, what's that mean? Other languages, they kind of have expressions that say, if you say someone is majestic, you're saying they are wonderful. To give you the idea that he's taken the seat at the right hand of the majesty of heaven, one who is truly wonderful. This, of course, is his Father. And he's sitting at the right hand of the Father. To be at the right hand of the Father in the family is to have the place and portion of blessing. Now, what this means here in this particular little section of this sentence is that the Son is in charge. Think in terms of a dramatic sense. He produces and directs the play. He sits in the most powerful seat, and this is the seat of absolute authority. Why is that? He's sitting at a throne right next to God. You don't want to get the idea that he's got a seat and he sits there and he never moves. No, this is his elected position. Who do you get elected by? Not me, and not any of you, by God himself. By God the Father himself. We would say a man holds a seat in the Senate. Now, I don't want to in any way compare this seat to the Senate seats in our government. When we think of a man holding a Senate seat, we think of a high office. He holds a high office. His seat is in the Senate. Does he just go sit there in the Senate and never leave? No. Speaking of authority, and that's what this is talking about here. But then he goes on to say, he wants to make this very clear, but the Son did not take that seat until something happened. Right there. He took the seat after he made a complete removal of sin. And there is why he has a name above every name. Why does he have a name above every name? Because what he did at the cross. This guy, not even mentioning cross, is he? He's saying, after a complete removal of sin, doesn't use the word cross. Why doesn't he use the word cross? Because he wants to focus on a complete removal of sin, which for the Jewish guy is going to go, that's what the priest does. He wants the Jewish guy to focus on sacrifice and priesthood. My mind, when I read this, runs to the cross, the crucifixion. The Jewish person, when he would read that line, would think, priesthood, sacrifice, that removes sin. All true. Did his position to have the greatest name above every name come easily? No. That by doing this, he became much better than angels, and that he inherited a name above every name. He inherited that name, yes, but only after he completed the work that was agreed upon in eternity past. So that's why this can take you back all the way back to eternity past and then all the way to eternity future, because he's sitting there and he's going to be there forever. It was after that that he became better. And I had to stop right there and say, wait a minute, how could he become better? Wasn't he always better than angels? Wasn't Jesus always better than angels? Why did he say that now he becomes better than angels? Wasn't he always? Well, as we're going to find out later in the book of Hebrews, you're going to find out that it says that God is going to make him a little lower than the angels for a while. It was after that, after completing the removal of sin, it was after that he was given a name we adore and we honor. And who adores and honors this name? Those who know him. And by saying we just know the name, I know the name Jesus, I've heard it, I can use the name Jesus. No, the word name here, the way the Hebrews and the Bible writers use it, is name means character and weight. And the word weight in Hebrew is the same word for glory. Kavod, glory and weight are synonyms. So a name is a character and weight. We use that expression, he became a big name. He's out there throwing his weight around. Oh, he's got a big name. He's famous. That's what that means. He has got a big name. And those of us who know who He is, we know His glory and we know that He's deserving of our honor. We know that. Now let's go to a translation. I looked at all the different translations and I pulled this one out because it's a little bit different than the standard translations. This is the NET Bible. I don't know if you're familiar with this. But it starts off, after God spoke long ago in various portions and in various ways, spoke to our ancestors rather than just to the fathers. He says ancestors. He wants to make the point that these are Jewish ancestors. These are our ancestors. Now, these aren't my ancestors. I'm not Jewish. Speaking to the Jewish audience, that these are your ancestors through the prophets. Were the prophets from other nations? Jewish prophets. These are Jews he's speaking to. That they understand this beginning of this, that God spoke. And they say, of course he spoke. We have the Bible to tell us that he spoke. But in these last days, and this is where he sets up a contrast, in these last days, or in this last time, he has spoken to us in a son, not a variety of ways, not in a variety of people, but one son, whom he appointed the heir of all things and through whom he created the world. So that's defining who the son is right there. He goes on to say then that the son, this son, who owns everything, and he created everything, he's the radiance of his glory. And I like that. See, the way they translate that is the way that most translators translate it. He is, being is the radiance of his glory and the representation or the character of his essence. Now, you've got this little Greek word character means to take an image and stamp it onto a coin. So every time you pull out a coin in your pocket, you want to know what Lincoln looks like? Just take out a penny and look. Now, I know what Lincoln looks like now. He looks like that. Do I know him personally? But see the image on there? That's an exact replication of the stamp they used to make that image. That's what that word means there. It's an exact representation. So he's inherited a position and a name and a character that is superior to angels. Does he tell us the son's name? Does he tell us the son's name? No, because he's not concerned about the name. He's concerned about the name, the character and the way. So he never uses the name Jesus. That does a couple things. Those who know Jesus, like you and me, we know who he's talking about. It's obvious. Now, these claims he's making, we go, you know, I've never really thought about it that way before. This guy is magnificent. To the readers, or the hearers, I should say, because this is supposed to be a sermon, so let's think of it as hearers. The hearers who do not know him, what are they going to say? Who could this be? Who could this possibly be? This can't be a human being. It can't be. But how did he do this? How did he accomplish cleansing for sin if he's not a human being? So the author of this book wants to reach both kinds of people. Those who know Jesus, well, why does he have to reach us? I already know. I mean, if I'm a believer and I believe in Jesus Christ, I'm done, right? I'm saved. I'm going to heaven. I'm done. I don't need to worry about this. If I got hauled into court today and my crime was being a Christian, could I be convicted on evidence? That's the question you want to ask yourself. But he's writing to also those who don't believe because he wants them to see the reality and the truth of who Jesus really is and the profound impact he can have on a life. If you come to the point where you believe in who he is, make a decision to follow him. Believing in Jesus is pursuing Jesus. There's no break. And that's what the author of Hebrews is going to argue. What God has said through Jesus is pretty much it. There's no more word coming from God. Anything you think you hear that God is telling you today, is it's either here and you're just having some vague memory of it, or it's not consistent with this and it's a lie. There is no new revelation from God. God has spoken. He's done. Jesus has been here. He's come. He left his apostles. They all died. They left the Bible. He's done. This book is describing Jesus as our great high priest in this age. He is the one who is dealing with us. And what the book of Hebrews is going to bring out is all these things. He's the Son of God. He's creator. He's prophet. He's priest. He's king. All the seeds of those ideas are in this sentence. And the rest of the book is going to expand on that. He's made the statement that he became better than the angels. Wait a minute. He was always better than the angels. You know what? In the Jewish mind, there was nothing greater than God. But under God were these creatures called angels. They were great. They sought to know angels. Now you can see why they would come to this conclusion. Because who do we see in the Torah? Quite a few times, we see this person called the angel of the Lord. And we know that that's Jesus pre-incarnate. What do the Jewish people think it is? Very powerful angel. So they came to revere angels. They had four archangels that they would pray to: Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, and I can't remember the fourth one. They had another panoply of angels that they would seek for guides. And so he's trying to say that, no, angels are good, but Jesus is better. He's got a better name because of what he did. This Jesus is the angel of the Lord of the Old Testament. But for the Jewish person to say that that angel of the Lord is Jesus, they go, that's impossible because a man can't be God. See the problem a Jewish person has? See the miracle it is when a Jewish person comes to Jesus Christ as Son of God, very God of very God? It's got to be the Holy Spirit working in their minds and in their hearts. So the same thing creeps into Gentile culture too, this worship of angels. And there was even a TV show a few years back, wasn't there, called
Touched
by an Angel. There you go. Yeah. What? Who can guide me through this spiritual morass? Oh, I'll find an angel. What's the writer of Hebrews arguing? No, Jesus is better. Are angels bad? Satan, what? He is an angel. Right? So there's, you don't know what kind of angel you're going to follow. But are God's angels good angels? Yes, absolutely they are. So that's what we're going to get to next week. He's going to tell us something about angels. 1:5 through 2:18, that whole big piece is about Jesus and angels. But I don't know how far I'll get this week. You know what we did today? We just kind of splashed around in the baby pool. That's all we did. We just kind of got our feet wet. We just kind of touched the water a little bit. Next week, we're going to go deeper. And you know what? As you go deeper and deeper into this book, it gets more treacherous. And the author of Hebrews is warning, as you get deeper, as you follow me deeper into this, some of you may drown. Some of you may not make it. Will you follow me anyway, even with that risk? What he's really saying, are you willing to give your entire life up for Jesus Christ? And that's the closest thing I'm ever going to get to an altar call, I guarantee you that. I'm going to pray. Ed, would you close after I pray, please? Dear Father, we do thank you.